Hey guys, this is Nikki, and you're listening to The Psychopath Less Traveled, the podcast where I tell you about a strange and bizarre psychological disorder, and I also lie to you by telling you that it's each week, when in reality, it's like far and few in between, honestly. And I'm sorry, I've been traveling, I got sick, I broke my mic, it's just a series of unfortunate events to this podcast, but I'm back. Hopefully they'll be coming out every 2 weeks. I'm gonna give myself some wiggle room there. But I did some traveling. I went to Ireland with a girlfriend of mine. I had a blast. The driving over there is insane. There's like hairpin, windy, two-lane roads that are super narrow. And it's like 80 kilometers an hour, which is, I don't know exactly what in miles per hour, but it's fast. It seems very fast, too fast to be going down a two-lane narrow road at like breakneck speed. So that was a bit challenging. They drive on the other side of the road. The steering wheel's on the other side. So there's a lot of branches that definitely scraped the side of the car. But by the end of it, I was a confident Ireland driver, somewhat. So between the last one and this episode, there's been like polar vortexes, and I was traveling. So in Buffalo, New York, they have something called the lake effect. And that just means basically when it snows, the wind is so crazy, it looks like you're in a snow globe. So my flight, I get in, I was supposed to get in at like 7, I get in at 11, I can barely see 2 feet ahead of the car, it's snowing, it's dark, nobody's on the road basically. I get to my hotel, I park, I get out of the car, get my suitcase, there's a man standing in front of my hotel, and he's like, "Hey, are you coming in?" And I was like, "Yep. Brought my suitcase for a reason. Yep. Checking in. Like, it's late. Let's get this show on the road." So he's standing there with a shovel. He just, like, seems like a normal guy. And then he looks at me after he asks me if I'm coming in. He goes, "You want to know how I'm psycho?" I was like, "What?" And then I was like, "What is happening? There's nobody else around." I was like, "This is a little crazy." I was like, "All right, I can still make it to my car. Like, I have my keys in my hand. Worst comes to worst, I'll just run super fast into the snow storm and disappear, and he won't be able to find me." So after I'm like, "What?" He goes, oh my God, I'm so sorry. "Want to know how I'm psychic?" I go, "Sure, lay it on me. How are you psychic?" And he goes, "Is your name Cheryl?" I go, "Nope, it's Nikki." And he goes, well, this conversation just didn't go as planned." And I was like, "It did not." He's like, "All right, let's get you out of the snow. Come check in." Turned out to be a wicked nice guy. But I was like, that could have gone in a terrible direction. And if there was no snow and he was standing there with a shovel, I wouldn't have even stopped. Because that's just, I mean, not the smartest decision. But it turned out to be fine. Hotel was great. I wake up the next morning. I'm not a 57-year-old man, so I don't drink my coffee and look out the window, so my blinds were closed. And I don't watch the news in the morning, so I got dressed for work, bundled up, went downstairs, brushed off my car. It was, like, snowing. The wind was blowing so much, and it was like, negative 23 degrees with the wind chill. It was insanely cold and snowy. Couldn't see anything. The roads weren't done at all. I'm like, man, this drive to work is going to be like a little challenging. So I get in my car. I plug in my first meeting location. I start driving. Bear in mind, the roads aren't cleared. There's barely anybody else on the road. And when I tell you, you can't see the hand in front of your face when the wind picks up, you literally cannot see the hand in front of your face. So I'm driving super slow in this blizzard on what looks like a highway. You can't see any of the traffic lights. I am going like 7 miles an hour because the roads are terrible. I'm not familiar with the car because I just rented it, so I didn't want to like be too fast and furious in an unknown area in the middle of a snowstorm. But I'm also from New England, so I'm like, I kind of have the balls in the sense that, okay, like I know how to handle snow. We've had some pretty wicked snowstorms, but I'm not done. So it takes me like 15 minutes to go like 2 miles. So I was like, this is insane. I can't do this. It's gonna take me 4 hours to get to the place that I'm going at this pace. And so I pull into a gas station. I'm like, all right, I'll grab some snacks. I'll grab an energy drink, whatever. I'll just see what the situation is. So I go into the gas station. It's me, the clerk, this other guy, and then a news crew. And they come up to me and they're like, hey, can we interview you for the news and about the blizzard and the polar vortex that's happening and the travel ban? I was like, hey, sorry, what's this now? There's a travel ban? They're like, yeah, all the roads, all the highways are shut down. Like, you're not, it's a state of emergency. You're not supposed to be on the road. Do you want to come stand outside with us and talk to us about the snowstorm and the travel ban? I was like, you want me to come stand outside for a in-depth conversation about the snow and negative 23 degree weather? I was like, no, thanks. I'm just gonna grab some snacks and climb back into bed and do email and conference calls for work instead today. But thanks. Be safe. Have a good one. So I just left. And then it was a state of emergency. Literally the whole week I was there, I was snowed into my snowstorm or my hotel for the whole week. It was kind of cool because it was crazy outside and it was less driving. It was a lot safer, but it was just so crazy. It started off wild. It ended wild with the snowstorm, but then I got back home and everything is fine. But I mentioned that I did some traveling in Ireland. And I found the craziest story about October 9th, 1967. And in a little town in Ireland, there was a fog storm. And it was around Halloween, so people kind of associate it with Halloween. But I mean, it was on October 9th, so we got a good ways for Halloween. Speaking of Halloween, I think for my costume this year, I'm gonna do the right to bear arms. And I'm just gonna wear, like, I have to find a bear onesie and just cut off the arms of it and wear those. And then I'm just gonna have a shirt printed that says right. So I'm the right to bear arms. Super corny. It'll keep me warm. That's all I care about. So a small town in Ireland had a thick, crazy eerie fog sweep in around 7 p.m. at night. Everybody was like, what's happening? It's 1976, so it's not like internet days or anything like that. People are just like, what's happening? What's going on? Everybody just went inside and then just locked up their houses. They're like, this is none of my business. I'm going inside. See ya tomorrow when the sun burns the fog. And so morning came, fog had all cleared out. Everybody started coming out of their houses, and once kind of everybody started talking in the town, they realized that the police received more than 60 calls from scared citizens who, like me, would have gone outside in the fog and been like, what's happening? I want to explore this. This looks super creepy. I'm about it. So they had all done what I would have done, gone outside, explored. And 60 people, so 60 people are calling the police, and this is what they told police. They said the dead were roaming the streets. So zombies were roaming the streets in Ireland amidst this fog, right? So this is where this story is just like, what is happening here? The police disregarded 60 calls and was just like, ah, this is just a big joke. Forget you guys. Fog makes my clothes damp. I don't want to deal with the outside. So when everybody starts to talk and, like, the police are kind of, like, patrolling the town the next morning when all the fog was gone, the police found the local graveyard had all of the graves dug up and none of the bodies were around. They were all gone, basically. So nobody knows exactly what happened here. There's not a lot of information on this story, but I'm just disappointed it didn't happen when I was there, because I would have made my friend go around with me, explore the fog, and, like, get into some, like, ghost shit, that kind of stuff. And just to give you a glimpse of what I was like as a kid in middle school before I got my license, I would make my friends come to graveyards with me and do, like, seances and ghost hunt. And my mom would drop us off at a graveyard, and then a few hours later she would pick us up. And at this point, I don't know if we had cell phones. Middle school, I'm 25. I think I got my first cell phone when I was 13. What grade are you in when you're 13? Who knows? But that's what I would do as a kid. So that's, I'm all about the creepy, the weird, the bizarre, all of that stuff. So there's the story about Ireland for you. There's a story about crazy weather and some weirdo who turned out to be really nice. And now let's get into the podcast. We're going to talk about David Berkowitz, a.k.a. the Son of Sam. And we're going to talk about Richard Chase, a.k.a. the Vampire of Sacramento. So get ready, get comfy, pay attention if you're driving. And, oh, also, for drivers who are driving while they're listening to this on their commute, or forcing somebody to listen who's giving you the aux cord, if you're in the leftist lane and people are passing you on your right, feel free to just get out of that lane, because you're going too slow for the fast lane if people are passing you on your right. That goes for any lane of traffic. If people are passing you in the slower lanes, move on over. Because it's just so frustrating when people are lollygagging in the fast lane at like 66 miles an hour. Just, I don't know what they're thinking, but it's just like, you look in your rear view mirror and there's a line of cars and nobody in front of you. Just move on over. It's super easy. Road rage is a huge problem everywhere. So help prevent road rage this week, and get the fuck over if you're going too slow. All right, let's start. So let's talk about schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is a chronic and severe mental disorder that affects how a person thinks, feels, and behaves. People with schizophrenia may seem like they have lost touch with reality, and although schizophrenia is not as common as other mental disorders, the symptoms can be very disabling. So some of the signs and symptoms usually start between the ages of 16 and 30, but in rare cases can develop in children as well. And these symptoms of schizophrenia fall into three categories: positive, negative, and cognitive. So the first is positive symptoms, and they are typically psychotic behaviors not generally seen in healthy people. People with these symptoms may lose touch with some aspects of reality, and they include hallucinations, delusions, thought disorders such as unusual or dysfunctional ways of thinking, and movement disorders like agitated body movements. So those are all the positive symptoms. Some of the negative symptoms are associated with disruptions to normal emotions and behaviors, such as the flat effect, which is reduced expression of emotions via facial expression or voice tone, reduced feelings of pleasure in everyday life, difficulty beginning and sustaining activities, and reduced speaking. So those are all the negative symptoms. Some of the cognitive symptoms for patients are subtle, but for others, they're more severe, and patients may notice changes in their memory or other aspects of thinking. These include poor executive functioning, which is the ability to understand information and use it to make decisions, trouble focusing or paying attention, and problems with working memory, which is the ability to use information immediately after learning it. So those are the cognitive symptoms. And the exact cause of schizophrenia is unknown. Some research suggests it's a combination of physical, genetic, and psychological environmental factors that can make a person more likely or less likely to develop the condition. Some people may be prone to schizophrenia, and it can be triggered by a stressful or emotional life event. So there are some sub-classifications of schizophrenia. The first one being hallucinations, so seeing or hearing things that aren't there. The second is delusions, mistaken but firmly held beliefs that are easy to prove wrong, like thinking you have superpowers or are a famous person or a certain sect of people are out to get you. The third is disorganized speech, using words and sentences that don't make sense to others. The fourth is strange behavior, acting in an odd or repetitive way, like walking in circles or writing all the time or even sitting perfectly still and quiet for hours on end. And the last one is withdrawn and lifeless, showing no feelings or motivation or lacking interest in normal day-to-day activities. So that gives you a brief summary of what schizophrenia is, some of the classifications and some of the symptoms when they start. We don't really know what causes them exactly, but that's kind of the schizophrenia bundle. So to be diagnosed with schizophrenia, somebody has to have at least two of the symptoms that I listed above for at least 6 months. One of them must be hallucinations, delusions, or disorganized speech, but a single voice that offers ongoing comments about your thoughts and actions or voices that talk to each other is enough to diagnose you with schizophrenia. There could have been times, however, when somebody didn't have any symptoms, but the first one would have started at least 6 months ago, and they must have had them for at least a month continuously. So the person may experience different symptoms at different times, and they may get worse or better, but it's still classified as schizophrenia. Doctors may categorize your schizophrenia according to your main symptom just to make the diagnosis clear to other people, but rather than say you have paranoid schizophrenia, they would say you have schizophrenia with paranoia, for example. So two facts that I found interesting while I was researching schizophrenia, the first being, so most of us are ticklish, either by getting tickled on your feet or like your rib cage by somebody else that, and I'm talking about being tickled so you have like that like crazy uncontrollable laughter that you just like can't help because it tickles so much. So the majority of us find it impossible to tickle ourselves to that same degree like other people can tickle us. However, a new study indicates that people with schizophrenia or schizophrenia-like symptoms may be capable of actually tickling themselves, thanks to the disruption of certain cognitive processes that distinguish between one's own actions and those of others. So basically, we non-schizophrenics can't tickle ourselves because our brain knows that it's our hand touching ourselves and trying to tickle us. However, schizophrenics, they don't have that clear pathway in their head, so their brain doesn't really know if it's an outside variable doing that or the actual individual tickling themselves. So that means that a lot of schizophrenics can tickle themselves because of that disconnect in their brain. So that's the first fact that I found out. And the second one is congenital blind people don't develop schizophrenia. And I didn't, like, there's a lot of research on that, but it was just a lot of research for me to read through. But you can fact check me if you want, read up on it. Totally up to you. And before we get into, like, the cases, I just want to make it perfectly clear that just because someone has this disorder doesn't mean they are going to be violent or ever going to be violent. In fact, the data suggests that people living with schizophrenia are more often the victims of violence rather than the perpetrators. One study found that there are at least four, so somebody with schizophrenia is at least 14 times more likely to be victims of a violent crime than to be arrested for one. So that's schizophrenia in a nutshell. I could go on about this and talk about the different connections in the brain and kind of like what people see, what people hear, what's most common, but that could honestly go on for way too long. So I thought I would just give you a brief synopsis of what it is, what the symptoms are, and then tell you about some absolutely like crazy cases that I found. So the first one is going to be David Berkowitz, aka Son of Sam, and the second one is going to be Richard Chase, which is the vampire killer of Sacramento. Are you guys ready? I'm ready. I'm excited. Okay, the first case that I'm going to cover with schizophrenia is David Berkowitz, like I said, aka the Son of Sam. So let's start with his early life. David Berkowitz was born Richard David Falcone on June 1st, 1953 in Brooklyn, New York. His unmarried parents separated shortly before he was born, and he was put up for adoption. His adoptive parents switched his first and middle names and gave him their surname. And from a young age, Berkowitz began to show early signs of his future violent behavior patterns. While he was of above-average intelligence, he lost interest in school and instead focused on more rebellious habits. He got involved with petty larceny, pyromania, which just means he started fires. However, his misbehavior never led to any legal troubles or impacted his school, really. When he was 14, Berkowitz's adoptive mother died of breast cancer, and his relationship with his adoptive father and new stepmother grew very strained. When he was 18, in 1971, Berkowitz entered the U.S. Army and served both in the U.S. as well as in South Korea. He was honorably discharged 3 years later. Berkowitz then tracked down his birth mother, Betty Falco. His mother told him about his illegitimate birth and the recent death of his birth father, which greatly upset Berkowitz. He eventually lost contact with his birth mother and began working a number of blue-collar jobs. So this is where his crimes begin. And according to his own accounts, Berkowitz's killing career began on December 24th in 1975, when he stabbed two women using a hunting knife. One of the women was Michelle Foreman, and the other has never been identified. In the early morning hours of July 29th, 1976, 18-year-old Donna Luria and 19-year-old Jody Valenti were sitting in Valentini's car when Berkowitz walked up to the car and shot them. He fired three shots and then just walked away. Laura was killed instantly and Valenti survived. When Valenti was questioned by police, she stated that she did not recognize him and gave a description, which fit with a statement by Laura's father, who said that he saw the same man sitting in a yellow car. And then there's other testimony by other individuals in the neighborhood stating that the yellow car had been seen driving around the neighborhood that night. So when they took the bullets back to wherever they test bullets, the police determined that the gun that was used was a .44 caliber bulldog. And I know nothing about guns, so I have no idea what that means. But then, fast forward a little bit to October 23rd, 1976, Berkowitz struck again, this time in Flushing, a community in the borough of Queens. Carl DeNaro and Rosemary Keenan were sitting in the car, it was also parked, when the windows just shattered. Keenan immediately started the car and drove off, and it was not until they got help that they realized they had been shot at. Even though DeNaro had a bullet wound in his head, both DeNaro and Keenan survived the attack, and neither saw the shooter. So he drove the car away once the windshield was shattered and, like, didn't realize until after the fact that he was shot in the head. How crazy is that? So police again determined that the bullets were from a .44 caliber, but they weren't able to determine what gun it came from, so they weren't able to tell if it was from a bulldog or not. And they occurred in two separate New York borough, so back then I guess like the police departments didn't talk, so they didn't put two and two together of like this could be the same guy. Shortly after that, on midnight of November 27th, 1976, 16-year-old Donna DeMazzi and 18-year-old Joanne Lamino were sitting on Lamino's porch in Belrose, Queens, and as they talked, a man approached them, dressed in a military outfit, and he began to ask them for directions to a high-pitched voice before taking out a revolver and shooting at them. They both fell, they were both injured, and he just ran away. Both girls survived their wounds, but Lamino was paralyzed, unfortunately. Police were able to determine that the bullets were from an unknown .44 caliber gun. They were also able to make a composite sketch based on the testimony from the girls and the neighborhood witnesses. Jumping forward a little bit, on January 30th, 1977, Christine Freund and John D.L. were sitting in D.L.'s car in Queens when the car was shot at. D.L. suffered minor injuries and Christine unfortunately died of injuries at the hospital. Neither victim ever saw the shooter, and after this shooting, police publicly connected the case with the previous shooting, and they observed that all shootings were, in fact, from a .44 caliber gun, and also that the shooter seemed to target young women with long, dark hair, and then they released the composite sketch from the various attacks, and kind of the New York Police Department didn't really know what they were looking for, so they said that it was multiple shooters. That was like the likeliest situation. So a lot of people actually, that was a popular hairstyle back in the day, long, dark hair. So a lot of people got their hair cut and like they changed the style of it so they wouldn't be targeted. I would do the exact same thing too. On March 8th, 1977, Columbia University student Virginia, I'm not going to be able to pronounce her last name, was shot walking home from class. She lived just one block away from fellow victim Christine, and she was shot several times and eventually died of a gunshot wound to the head. In the minutes following the shooting, a neighbor who heard the shooting went outside and saw what he described. It was a short, husky teenage boy sprinting from the crime scene. Other neighbors reported seeing the teenager as well as a man matching Berkowitz's description in the area of the shooting. The earliest media coverage implied that the teenager was the perpetrator. Eventually, though, police officers determined that the teenager was a witness and not a suspect. So a lot of the reports came in and they reported like a young like teenager with blonde hair like running away. And then the police were like, that could be a witness because he heard the gunshots and then ran away, you know, just like the other people would do when they heard gunshots, they would just run away. So they didn't necessarily think of that description of that person as being a suspect. On April 17th, 1977, Alexander Esau and Valentia Serrani were in the Bronx, several blocks away from the scene at the Valenti Laura shooting. The pair were each shot twice while sitting in a car, and both died before they could talk to police. Investigators determined that they were killed by the same suspect in the other shootings with the same .44 caliber firearm. At the crime scene, police discovered a handwritten letter used and that was left like by the scene, and it was addressed to the captain of the New York Police Department. In this letter, Berkowitz referred to himself as the Son of Sam and expressed his desire to continue his shooting sprees. So this is what this letter said. "I am deeply hurt by you calling me a woman hater. I am not, but I am a monster. I am the Son of Sam. I am the little brat. When Father Sam gets drunk, he gets mean. He beats his family. Sometimes he ties me up to the back of the house. Other time he locks me in the garage. Sam loves to drink blood. Go out and kill, commands Father Sam. Behind our house, some rest. Mostly young, raped and slaughtered, their blood drained, just bones now. Papa Sam keeps me locked in the attic, too. I can't get out, but I look at the attic window and watch the world go by. I feel like an outsider. I'm on a different wavelength than everybody else, programmed to kill. However, to stop me, you must kill me. Attention all police, shoot me first, shoot to kill, or else. Keep out of my way, or you will die. Papa Sam is old now. He needs some blood to preserve his youth. He has had too many heart attacks. Too many heart attacks. Ugh. Me hoot, it hurts, sonny boy. I miss my pretty princess most of all. She's resting in our lady's house, but I'll see her soon. I am the monster, Beelzebub, the chubby behemoth. I love to hunt, prowl the streets, looking for fair game, tasty meat. The women of Queens are prettiest of all. I must be water they drink. I live for the hunt, my life. Blood for Papa, Mr. Borelli, sir, I don't want to kill any more. No, sir. No more, but I must. Honor thy father. I want to make love to the world. I love people. I don't belong on earth. Return me to Yahoos, to the people of Queens. I love you, and I want to wish you all a happy Easter. May God bless you in his life and in the next. And for now, I say goodbye and good night. Police, let me haunt you with these words. I'll be back. To be interpreted as bang, 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 bang. Ugh. Yours in murder, Mr. Monster. So that was a letter that was left by David Berkowitz. So with all these shootings happen, people, police are on high alert. So after the information from the first letter and the connections between the previous shootings, the drawings of the perpetrator from the witnesses, investigators began to create a psychological profile for the suspect. The suspect was described as neurotic, potentially suffering from paranoid schizophrenia, and believed that he was possessed by demons. Police also tracked down every legal owner of a .44 caliber Bulldog revolver in New York City and questioned them. In addition to forensically testing the guns, they were unable to determine which was the murder weapon. Police also set up traps of undercover police officers posing as couples in parked cars in the hopes that the suspect would reveal himself. So they just had staged police cars, like undercover cars, obviously, with couples in the passenger and the driver's side in hopes that somebody would start to approach the car and they could, like, swarm in. So on May 30th, 1977, Jimmy Breslin, who is a columnist for the Daily News, received the second Son of Sam letter, and it was postmarked for the same day from Englewood, New Jersey, so pretty close by. The envelope had the words, blood and family, darkness and death, absolute depravity, 44, written on the reverse side. And in the letter, the Son of Sam stated that he was a reader of Breslin's column and referred to several of the past victims. He also continued to mock the New York City Police Department over its inability to solve the case. In this letter, he also asks, what will you have for July 29th? Investigators believed that this was a warning, as July 29th would be the anniversary of the first shooting. One notable observation was that the letter seemed to be written in a more sophisticated manner than the first one. This led investigators to believe that the letter could have been written by a copycat. So once he got the letter, he obviously shared it with the police, and then about a week later, it was okay to be published, and this is what the second letter read. Hello from the gutters of NYC, which are filled with dog manure, vomit, stale wine, urine, and blood. Hello from the sewers of NYC, which swallow up these delicacies when they are washed away by the sweeper trucks. Hello from the cracks in the sidewalks of NYC, and from the ants that dwell in these cracks, and feed in the dried blood of the dead that has settled into the cracks. JB, I'm just dropping you a line to let you know that I appreciate your interest in those recent and horrendous 44 killings. I also want to tell you that I read your column daily, and I find it quite informative. Tell me, Jim, what will you have for July 29th? You can forget about me if you like, because I don't care for publicity. However, you must not forget Donna Laura, and you cannot let the people forget her either. She was a very, very sweet girl, but Sam's a thirsty lad, and he won't let me stop killing until he gets his fill of blood. Mr. Breslin, sir, don't think that because you haven't heard from me in a while that I went to sleep. No, rather, I am still here, like a spirit roaming the night, thirsty, hungry, seldom stopping to rest, anxious to please Sam. I love my work. Now, the void has been filled. Perhaps we shall meet face to face someday, or perhaps I will be blown away by cops with smoking 38s. whatever. If I shall be fortunate enough to meet you, I will tell you all about Sam, and if you like, I will introduce you to him. His name is Sam the Terrible. Not knowing what the future holds, I shall say farewell, and I will see you at the next job. Or should I say, you will see my handiwork at the next job. Remember, Miss Laura, thank you. In her blood, from the gutter, Sam's creation. Point 44, here are some of the names to help you along forward. Them to your inspector for use by NCIC. The Duke of Death, the Wicked King Wicker, the 22 Disciples of Hell, John Wheaties, Rapist and Suffocator of Young Girls. P.S. Please inform all the detectives working on the slaying to remain. P.S. J.B. Please inform all the detectives working on the case that I wish them the best of luck. Keep them digging. Drive on. Think positive. Get off your butts. Knock on coffins, etc. Upon my capture, I promise to buy all the guys working the case a pair of new shoes if I can get up the money. Son of Sam. So that's the second letter, okay? So by then, people are changing their hairstyle, they're on high alert all the time, and on June 26, 1977, the Son of Sam made another appearance in Bayside, Queens. Sal Lupo and Judy Placido were sitting in their car in the early morning hours when they were shot with 3 gunshots. They both suffered minor injuries and survived, though neither saw their attacker. However, witnesses reported seeing a tall, stocky man with dark hair fleeing the crime scene, as well as a blonde man with a mustache driving in the area. Police believed that the dark man was their suspect and the blonde man again was a witness. On July 31st, 1977, just 2 days after the anniversary of the shooting, Berkowitz shot again, this time in Brooklyn. Stacy Moskowitz and Robert Valenti were in Valenti's car parked near a park where a man walked up to the passenger side and began shooting. Moskowitz died in the hospital and Valenti suffered non-life-threatening injuries, thank God. Unlike most of the other female victims, Moskowitz did not have long or dark hair, and there are several witnesses to this shooting who were able to provide descriptions of the shooter to police. One of the witnesses described that the man looked like he was wearing a wig, which could account for the varying descriptions of suspects with blonde and dark hair. Several witnesses saw a man matching Berkowitz's description wearing a wig, driving a yellow car without any headlights, and speeding away from the crime scene. So police decided to investigate the owners of any yellow cars matching the description. David Berkowitz's car was one of those cars, but investigators initially pegged him as a witness rather than a suspect, so they let him go. Local resident Cecilia Davis was walking her dog at the scene of the Moskowitz and Valenti shooting when she saw patrol officer Michelle Cantino ticketing a car that was parked near a fire hydrant. Moments after the police officer had left, after she gave the car a ticket, a young man walked past Cecilia from the area of the car, and he seemed to study her with some kind of interest. She got like a bad vibe from him and was just like, oh geez, like, get me away from this guy. And she also was pretty much concerned because she saw this guy that was giving her a bad vibe like wielding something in his hand. And she didn't really know what it was, but she described it as a dark object. So she ran to her home only to hear shots fired behind her on the streets. So she was obviously scared beside herself. So she remained silent about this experience for 4 days until she finally contacted police, who closely checked every car that had been ticketed in the area that night because they knew that was going to be their suspect. So on August 10th, 1977, police found Berkowitz's car, and then when they looked inside, they found a rifle in the back seat, like, in plain view. Because of that, they were able to search his car, and they discovered a duffel bag filled with ammunition, maps of the crime scene, and an unsent Son of Sam letter addressed to Sergeant Dowd of the Omega Task Force. So, because they didn't have a search warrant to search his car, they had to wait for Berkowitz to leave his apartment because hopefully by the time that he left, they could arrest him for having all that stuff in his car. So they were like, we'll just wait it out. We'll wait for a warrant. Whatever one happens first, either the warrant or he comes out, we'll just arrest him. Because they didn't also want to endanger like all the stuff that they found without a legal warrant, because you can't just like go into somebody's house, find stuff, and then have it be used in court. It has to be obtained legally. So that was a good move on their part. So the warrant still had not arrived when they were like standing outside of Berkowitz's house, and he finally left his apartment building at about 10 p.m. and entered his car. Detective John Falotico approached the driver's side of the car, and he pointed his gun close to Berkowitz's temple. And then while Sergeant Detective William Gradella pointed his gun from the passenger side. So they had him on both sides with guns. He had with him a paper bag containing a .44 caliber Bulldog revolver of the type that was identified in ballistics tests, was found next to Berkowitz in that paper bag right with him. As described in Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klossner, Detective Falotico remembered the big, inexplicable smile on David Berkowitz's face. And then apparently when Berkowitz was arrested, he allegedly told police, "Well, you got me. How come it took you such a long time?" So they have him, he's in custody, they get the warrant to search his house, and when they did search his apartment, they found satanic graffiti drawn on all the walls and diaries detailing his alleged 1,400 arsons in the New York area. And when Berkowitz was taken in for questioning, he quickly confessed to the shootings and stated that he would plead guilty. And when police asked what his motivation for the killing spree was, he said that his former neighbor, Sam Carr, had a dog that was possessed by a demon, which told Berkowitz to kill. Sam Carr is the same Sam that inspired his nickname, the Son of Sam. So Berkowitz was sentenced to 25 years in prison for each murder, served in New York's Supermax prison, Attica Correctional Facility. And in February 1979, Berkowitz held a press conference and stated that his claims about demonic possession were a hoax. Berkowitz stated to a court-appointed psychiatrist that he was lashing out in anger against the world that he felt had rejected him. He felt that he had been particularly rejected by women, which could be one of the reasons that he specifically targeted attractive young women. And in 1990, Berkowitz was moved to Sullivan Correctional Facility, where he remains today. So, not much good came of this besides the Son of Sam law. And in New York, it was the first state that enacted this law, called the Son of Sam law. Many other states quickly followed suit. So, the law essentially prohibits those convicted of crimes from profiting off of those crimes. So, New York and a bunch of other states bans crimes from obtaining any sums of money for talking about or selling their stories for a period of 5 years. So, any money that the inmate makes goes into an account that later goes to the victims of those crimes. And in this case, Berkowitz, any money he would have made directly would benefit the survivors of the families of his victims that did not survive. So, the Son of Sam law stopped several criminals from profiting off their murders and other actions since its enactment. Ira Inhorn, the so-called unicorn killer, that sounds interesting, came close to signing a book deal before a Texas court determined that any money he made from the book would go to the family of his victims, Holly Maddox. The law also bans the selling and profiting of murder memorabilia associated with crimes online and in prison. And so basically, the Son of Sam law says that if you're a killer, like, you can't get paid for any interviews, any book deals, selling any of your stuff to people. And if you do, all of the money goes to those, the families of the victims. So that's, it's a terrible thing to have this kind of, like, come from, but it helps a lot of criminals not make any money off of their terrible, terrible crimes. So that, ladies and gentlemen, is the first case, and it's the case of David Berkowitz, a.k.a. the Son of Sam. Ooh, are you guys ready for the case of Richard Chase, a.k.a. the Vampire Killer of Sacramento? Fair warning here, it gets pretty gross, pretty gruesome right off the bat. So if you guys are not about that stuff. Please don't listen to this specific case because it gets super, super, super gross. But before we get started, I have a joke about just the name Richard. So, you know how Dick is a nickname for Richard? So the joke goes like this. It says, how do you get Dick from Richard? Just like, you ask him nicely. Okay, back to Richard Chase. He was born May 23rd, 1950 in Santa Clara, California. And he was a crazy troubled child because partially he was born like that and he had terrible abusive parents. As a kid growing up, he exhibited signs of arson, bedwetting, and cruelty to animals. And these three habits are sometimes called the McDonald Triad or the Triad of Sociopath, the proposed by psychiatrist J.M. McDonald in 1963. So the McDonald Triad, to just give you a little piece of information for a trivia night, is the medical indicator used to determine if a child has a likely chance of eventually becoming a sociopath. Chase, like I said, met all three of these criteria. He was a chronic bedwetter by age 8, and by age 10, he liked to set fires, and he also captured and killed animals. So these three traits are also shared with a bunch of other serial killers, like Jeffrey Dahmer, for example. And sociopaths, just as a brief recap for everybody, are also referred to as psychopaths or individuals with antisocial personality disorder. These individuals who have a blunted sense of empathy and inclination towards risk, violence, and manipulation, and that's combined with a complete lack of remorse for anyone they hurt. Sociopaths, they know right from wrong, they just don't care and do whatever they like. After his capture, like, spoiler alert, sorry, two psychiatrists determined that Chase exhibited zero signs of remorse or guilt for any of the crimes he had ever committed. So let's go back real quick to hurting animals because it gets so much worse, and this was a huge part in Richard Chase's life and obviously escalated to more than just animals. So Richard Chase, at the age of 10, remind you, dismembered, ate, and drank the blood of animals even before he started murdering. So he wanted to kill them and dismember them so he could drink their blood. And that was an obsession that he had that would follow him throughout the rest of his life. Can you imagine that? Just a 10-year-old, like, the neighborhood cats keep going missing and you check your tool shed one day for the rake and you just find like a bloody mass of dismembered animals and like maybe a bucket of blood with a cup next to it. You're like, oh my God, somebody, I need professional help for my kid for sure. Just be a crazy scene to stumble upon. So, like most people, Chase turned to alcohol and drugs as an adolescent, and that quickly turned into heavy substance abuse. And he also developed a slew of other odd behaviors that pointed to potential trouble later on in life. So, besides his bloodlust for animals and his other odd behaviors and substance abuse, he also developed hypochondria. So the definition of a hypochondriac is a person who thinks always that something is wrong with them or who is abnormally worried about his or her health. It's a person who fears that every single ache or sniffle is a sign of a life-threatening disease. And so that's what a hypochondriac is. So in his delusions, he often complained that his heart would occasionally stop beating. Also, like, that one specific thing could be related to Cotard's delusion that we discussed last week. Or he also believed that someone had stolen his pulmonary artery, which I think is around your heart or connected to your heart, if I were to take a guess. So to combat this from happening, he would hold two oranges on either side of his head, believing that the vitamin C would be absorbed by his brain via diffusion. Chase also believed that his cranial bones had become separated and were moving around. So in order to monitor and watch his cranial bones move, he shaved his head. Okay. He constantly complained to everybody of illnesses from headaches to stomach pains, and even once claimed that his stomach was backwards, and a few more things too. So these delusions were so great that he was committed and diagnosed with schizophrenia and somatic delusions in 1976, which were largely the cause of his hypochondria. So that's what he was committed for in 1976. But before that, he went to a few psychologists, and besides diagnosing him with suppressed anger and a few other things, he would constantly take out his rage on his friends, family, and loved ones, and his future victims. At age 18 in the late 1960s, one psychiatrist diagnosed him with erectile dysfunction, citing his suppressed rage as a direct cause. And as a teenager, Chase could not maintain an erection without killing animals. So he had to go kill an animal to get aroused. So, not the best time in the bedroom. So, fueled by his paranoid schizophrenia, by the age of 22, Richard Chase was arrested for possession of a firearm. And this would not be the last time he was caught with a gun. So this guy, wherever he went, he just carried around a gun, always. And he always had a weapon on him to kill animals, to do with whatever he thought in his, like, delusional mind. And his choice of weapon usually was a .22 caliber pistol. So on August 3rd, 1977, Chase's truck was discovered near a Native American reservation where police found a .30-30 rifle along with another rifle and his signature .22 caliber pistol inside. They also, among other things, discovered that he had taken a cow's liver and removed it, placing it in a bucket, and then smearing the blood on his naked body. So they found him like that. They found a truck with a bunch of guns in it, and then they found him with a bucket with a cow's liver and blood all over his body. However, tribal and federal land required federal prosecution, and the United States District Attorney decided to withhold prosecution, which is a big bummer considering what happened after that. At one point, Chase even managed to convince himself that he was part of the Younger Brothers, which was an outlaw gang associated with Jesse James. And for a long time, Chase actually believed that his mother was trying to poison him, and then the Nazis and the FBI and other organizations were after him. So, is very paranoid, has crazy delusions, just not normal trains of thought in the slightest bit. And in his state of mind, he thought the only way to stop all of his bones from moving, for his heart to regularly beat, and for his stomach to flip so it wasn't backwards anymore, he thought that he had to drink blood. And he thought by drinking blood that it would stop the FBI and the Nazis from poisoning him, and if they already had poisoned him, drinking blood would help, like, fix all of these problems, okay? So clearly, definitely not in a good state of mind, and wasn't getting any help from either drugs or therapy or anything like that. He was just, like, left to his own delusions at this point, okay? So Chase was institutionalized in the mid-1970s, which this would be his first major institutionalization, and it only happened because he got really sick and he contracted blood poisoning by injecting rabbit's blood into his veins. So he would capture a rabbit, he would take a syringe that he got from God knows where. He would remove some of the rabbit's blood, and then he would stick the needle inside of his arm, and he would push the blood into his arm. He would push the rabbit's blood into his arm, and because of that, he got blood poisoning, got really sick, had to go to the doctor. He showed up at the ER. He was like, I'm sick. They were like, well, what have you been doing? He's like, well, you see, I have all these things wrong with me, so I injected rabbit's blood. And they were like, oh, well, we'll fix that, but then to fix your head, we're going to stick you over here to get you some help, because clearly he was not in a good place. And I'm not saying that as an excuse. I'm just saying that he was, like, delusional. Like, he was living in a world, and it wasn't this one. He was not living with the rest of us. He was living somewhere far, far away in his head. So rabbits weren't the only things. He would also drink the blood from any small animal he could find, different creatures. And like I said before, he had a deep core belief that blood and only blood could save him from his paranoid delusions. And you know what? They weren't even paranoid delusions to him. That's what he believed. It's like, he believed that this was happening as strongly as if you broke your arm and needed a cast for it. That's how strongly he believed that this was happening, and that would fix it. Just as, like, we believe that a cast will fix a broken arm, which it does. So, blood, 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 all the time blood. One time, while he was institutionalized, hospital staff discovered him with blood all over his face. And then they were like, hey, Richard, what's you okay? Why is there blood all over your face? And he was like, oh, no, I just accidentally cut myself shaving. No big deal. Like, don't worry about it. It's just a shaving nick. I got it. Later, they discovered that Chase was killing birds and drinking their blood. He was disposing of their bodies when he was let outside. And so what he would do, he would sneak food to like a windowsill, open up the window, leave the food on the sill, the birds would fly up, and he would like ninja hand grab the bird, break their necks, and then like tear open their bodies, I guess, and then just drink the blood from the birds. And that's what, it wasn't a shaving incident, it was bird blood all over his face. So the staff nicknamed him Dracula, because of his blood fixation, obviously. It was a spot-on nickname. He also extracted blood from therapy dogs with stolen syringes. So they would let therapy dogs go in and visit with the patients. He was like, how do I get in on that blood? He stole syringes off of a cart and like tucked them up his sleeve. And then when they would let him visit the dogs, he would just yoink, steal some blood from them. Ooh. So Chase obviously was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, as he was before when he saw psychiatrists. And after undergoing a battery of treatments involving psychotropic drugs, there we go, Chase was deemed no longer a danger to society, and later in 1976, he was released to his mother's custody. The same mother that had beat him as a child and he believed was poisoning him, okay? She picks him up from the institution. She's like, Richard, welcome home. Let's go home. Let's live our lives blood-free. He was like, okay, sounds great. Looking forward to this vegetarian lifestyle. And so after living at his mother's house for a while, she was like, oh, he seems fine. Like, he doesn't need his medication anymore. So she started weaning him off of his medication. So, again, Mother of the Year award goes to this fucking lady. After a while, so after he was completely weaned off of his medication, all of his delusions and paranoia and crazy ideas started to come back, and he was convinced once again that his mother was poisoning him. So he was like, I have to get out of here. And she helped him find an apartment and move into that apartment. She was like, yep, you seem like you, so go be with friends at a different space other than my house. So when he moved in, everything was cool for probably like a day or two. And then his roommates started like watching him do all of these weird things. So he was constantly high, constantly drunk, and was tripping on LSD all the time. And he constantly walked around naked with a gun strapped to him, even with company over. So they were like, they sat him down on the couch one day, they put some saran wrap on the couch so his butt wouldn't touch it, and they were like, hey, Richard, you need to move out because we're tired of seeing you naked, and we're tired of you just tripping and being drunk and being high all the time and doing weird shit around us. Can you please move out? And he was like, nope, not gonna happen. I'm staying here. All of his roommates were like, well, that's that. We're moving out. So they all moved out. And when he was left alone in the apartment just by himself, his tendencies became more extreme and more gruesome. Can you believe it? More gruesome than what we've already heard. It again started with capturing and killing small animals. He then would eat them raw or blend the organs with soda and drink the mixture. And he believed by ingesting the creatures, he was preventing his heart from shrinking, just like the Grinch. So he had a bunch of like different recipes that he would do. Like he would cook with the blood and the animals, and he would blend it up and ingest it with needles, like in liquid form, like a smoothie. And there was like just blood everywhere. Ugh. Ew, ew, ew. Can you imagine the smell? Oh, and what he must have just looked like, just like walking around, just like super emaciated. Is that it? Emaciated? Because he wasn't like eating anything besides putting up those two oranges to his head, and he was just constantly drinking blood. A lot of iron poisoning, I bet, on one of the many things that was wrong with him after that. Okay. So now I'm going to stop you for a minute and just think to yourself about how many serial killers there are right now, just lurking, stalking, following their soon-to-be victims on social media, on your Snapchat maps, which let me just tell you guys, you can stalk somebody so hard on Snapchat maps. For those of you who don't know what it is, Snapchat is an app that lets you send pictures that disappear after a certain amount of time. And there's a map feature that you can go into and go to the app. And if people have their like geolocation turned on, you can see exactly where a person is at any time. How fucking crazy is that? So guys, please turn off your geolocation on your Snapchat, because that's how you get stalkers. That's how you get crazy people to know exactly where you are. Also, if you lie to your friends and say you're one place and they look at the map and you're actually another place, you get caught in lies too. So just turn it off. There's no good that can come from it. Just text your friends, say, hey, where are you? All right. So when he was eventually captured, he was asked how he went about choosing his victims. And Richard Chase responded that he would check doorknobs down the street until he found one to be unlocked. He had no further necessities in a victim, just that the door had to be unlocked. And his core motives were neither financial or sexual, but rather out of pure bloodlust and a desire for, like, carnage and to eat people and drink their blood. He also told them that locked doors were a sign that he was not welcome. And he specifically remembered one time going out during the night to stalk for prey aka people, and finding a door unlocked. But then he decided that that particular resident, whoever she may be, is still unknown, should live. So it was kind of like fate. So always lock your doors. He would go prowling. He'd just be walking down the street, looking like a vampire ghost man. And he would walk up to people's houses. He'd be like, oh, is this door unlocked? If it was unlocked, he'd just swoop, sneak in. And if it wasn't and it was locked, he would turn around and walk away and go to the next house. So everybody, if for nothing that you learn from this, just lock your doors. It's always safer that way. Always safer that way. So even more terrifying than just an unlocked door, when police finally caught up with Chase, his calendar had the word today written on days he committed murder. There were 44 future days with the word today already written on them when they saw his calendar. So he would plan out. He'd be like, Thursday seems like a good day for murdering. He would write today on it. Then he'd be like, Saturday of this week, also I'm free, also is a good day to plan for some murders, check some doors. Just basically old school cold calling. And he was like, oh, I'm just welcome myself in. Like vampires, little more trivia facts for you guys. Vampires, in order to enter a residency, so your home, have to be invited in. So that was another weird connection that they made between his like delusions and like literal vampires. They drink blood, they have to be invited in. Richard, check. He was like, how to be a vampire, drink blood, check. He was like, invited into houses or unlocked doors, check. So he had a calendar. His schedule was full. When he did have sex with his victims, his murderous rampage seemed to be inspired by nothing more primary than his desire to consume human blood. And it was because of that like crazy disorganized nature and just like no plan, no schedule whatsoever, he managed to evade capture. Because there was no rhyme, no reason to his killings. And investigators, when they looked at all of these, like, different murders and different MOs and stuff, they couldn't, like, discern a real pattern to it all. Because there was no pattern to it. It was just all random. So now we get to the killings. His first kill was on December 29th, 1977. And it was Ambrose Griffin. He was a 51-year-old father of two who was helping his wife bring in groceries when Chase killed him in a drive-by shooting with his beloved 22 caliber pistol. His wife actually looked back at him and thought her husband was having a heart attack when he fell and didn't even realize he was shot until she ran over to him and there was blood all over her. He then, 2 weeks later, attempted to enter the home of a woman, but because her doors were locked, he walked away. He was once caught and chased off by a couple returning home as he pilfered their belongings, and he, strangely enough, had also urinated and defecated on their infant child's bed and clothing. So, gross. On January 23rd, 1978, Chase entered the home of Teresa Wallen, who was pregnant, and through her unlocked front door, he shot her 3 times using the same gun he used to shoot Griffin, his .22 caliber. He then proceeded to stab her with a butcher knife, and he cut off one of her nipples and then had sex with her corpse before cutting her organs out and drinking her blood. And he used an empty yogurt container as a cup to scoop up her blood and drink it. And when she was found, a few of her organs were also missing, so he took those as well with him. Ooh. He also stuffed dog feces from her front yard down her throat before leaving. Chase was a coprophiliac. which means that he had a compulsive obsession with the ingestion of human feces. The blood is bad enough, but like the eating of poop is just on another level. Like the human centipede. The fact that they made one movie, that the guy pitched the idea and he was like, this is my vision. I want three people in a row doing the grossest shit that I could think of. And it's going to be like this artsy, like weird style film. The guy was like, I love it. I'll help you produce it. Then that happened two more times. They made three of those movies. I think they should have just stopped when the guy came in and was like, hey, this is my idea. They'd be like, let me show you something. They just walk him to his car. They're like, have a good day and never come back here, you crazy, crazy person. All right. So we're going to skip some just because it's all terrible. It's all gross. It's all bad. I don't want to talk about it that much. But the final murder spree Chase went on before getting caught was the most gruesome of all. So prepare yourselves. It was on January 27th, 1978, just 4 days after Wallen's murder. And the victims included Jason Maroth, his mother Evelyn, and a friend named Dan Meredith. They were all killed by Chase inside Evelyn's home. So Dan Meredith was murdered in the hallway, dead by a gunshot wound to the head. And then Chase took his car keys. Evelyn and Jason were found in Evelyn's bedroom. There was also a 6-year-old, and he had been shot in the head twice. So Evelyn was partially cannibalized. Her stomach was cut open, and she had multiple organs missing as well. And there was also a failed attempt to remove one of her eyes, and she had also been sodomized. That's a bummer. 22-month-old David Fiera was Evelyn's nephew, who she was babysitting at the time, and was the only one missing from the scene of the crime. So this family and the visitor, he had just walked up to the door, it was unlocked, came in, started shooting everybody, and then cannibalizing somebody. And there was a large blood stain in the crib where the infant once laid, so everybody expected the worst. And the child's decapitated corpse was found months later behind a church. It came out during the trial that the knock of a visitor startled Chase, who took the boy's body and fled with Dan Meredith's stolen car. And the person who knocked on the door, probably because they heard gunshots or maybe they planned to come, I'm not really sure, saw the scene and alerted a neighbor, who then called the cops, and the authorities were able to identify Chase's handprint smeared on the wall in blood. So they were able to get his fingerprints, thankfully, and he was arrested shortly after. And then when the police walked into Chase's apartment, they found all of the walls, the floors, every basic like kitchen surface and like dining surface was covered in like caked on layers of just gross blood, and all of his dishware and utensils were just like stained with blood. I'm sure he didn't do a lot of cleaning at all. So he was arrested, they searched his apartment. Then here's the trial part. So the trial of Richard Chase began on January 2nd, 1979, and lasted for 5 months. The defense attorney rejected the suggested death penalty on the grounds that Chase was not guilty by reason of insanity. In the end, after 5 hours of deliberation, the jury took the side of the prosecution, and Richard Chase, the Vampire of Sacramento, was found guilty of 6 counts of murder and sentenced to death by gas chamber. His fellow inmates who knew of his crimes were frightened by him so much that they often just, like, shouted at him wherever he went to just kill himself, and, nobody wants you alive, like, put us all out of our misery by, like, interacting with you, just kill yourself. So, Richard Chase did just that. He overdosed on the stockpile of drugs he was keeping, and he was found dead in his jail cell the day after Christmas in 1980. And that is the terrible, gruesome case of Richard Chase, aka the Vampire of Sacramento. All right, let's wrap this episode up. So, here are some crazy, cool coincidences that happened to people in case you're feeling bummed out. So, a little known fact, men are more likely to be struck by lightning than women. I don't know why. I can only wildly speculate as to why that's true. People are standing outside more. If they're guys, just love carrying around metal poles. Who knows? But this guy, he was a park ranger. His name is Roy C. Sullivan. He was struck by lightning 7 times and survived every single one of them. And the odds of the same person getting struck by lightning 7 times are like 22, and then add like 20 zeros to that number. I don't even know what that number is called. It's like 22 bazillion million trillion to 1. 7 times. That guy should have bought a lottery ticket. Also, this is kind of cool. It's very poetic. Halley's Comet was in the sky when Mark Twain was born. And then the next time it appeared was the day Twain died. And here's the crazy part. He predicted it. He said, quote, "I came with Halley's Comet." Nope. He said, quote, "I came in with Halley's Comet. It is coming again, and I expect to go out with it. The Almighty has said, no doubt. Now here are these two unaccountable freaks. They came in together, and they must go out together," end quote. So, he was born and died in the period of Halley's Comet coming and then coming again, which was pretty cool. Also, if you're still feeling bummed out after those cases and want a cool video to look up, so Astronauts Who Forget They're on Earth is a pretty funny watch. It's just a bunch of astronauts giving interviews, and they'll like have something in their hand, like a pen or like a ball or whatever, and they forget that they're on Earth because in space there's no gravity, right? So if you let go of something in midair, it just stays in midair. So there's a bunch of astronauts who just keep like putting pens up in the air to like point to something and then just dropping them and being like, "Ah, I forgot that I was on Earth. I forgot about gravity," which is so funny to me that people just do that when they come back from space. Okay, well, that was this episode. Hopefully one comes out soon. But don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Tell me what I'm doing good. Tell me what I'm doing terribly. Either way, love it. Find this podcast on Twitter, on Instagram, and you can always email me with crazy coincidences or cool ghost stories or anything like that at thepsychopathlesstraveled@gmail.com. And I hope you guys have a really wonderful week. Stay warm, stay safe. If you live somewhere that's hot, stay cool. And have a great week.